Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in DuPont v. Robinson.
May it please the court, Ms. Pamela Barrett and Mr. Mike Hatchell, we have argued for petitioner. Petitioner has agreed to 6 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Barrett will open the first portion.
At issue is the proof, is the standard for admitting expert scientific testimony under Texas Rule of Civil Evidence 702. More specifically, the issue here is, did the trial judge abuse his discretion in excluding the testimony of Dr. Carl Wickham on grounds that it was scientifically unreliable and speculative? Dr. Wickham was the sole expert witness on causation for the plaintiff. He was to testify that the Robinson orchard was damaged and dying because of the application of a very commonly used DuPont fungicide, Benlate 50DF. The theory of causation through Wickham was not that the benlate itself caused the damage, but that the benlate was contaminated with SU herbicides, plant-killing chemicals. Wickham's theory of causation worked backwards from the damage to establish any evidence of connection that he did not know and made no effort to establish. He repeatedly admitted that he didn't know if the particular benlate used on the Robinson orchard was contaminated, but he said, because I see symptoms of damage at the orchard, therefore the particular benlate was contaminated. He said it was contaminated, though, in such small amounts that you could not detect it with the most advanced scientific measuring instruments. Repeatedly asked if he knew how much SU contamination it would take to injure grown pecans, he said he didn't know. So he didn't know if it was below or above these detectable limits. Nonetheless, he pointed again to the end result to establish that causal connection. He said, because I see damage on the trees, therefore pecan trees must be sensitive to SU contamination in very small amounts. He also repeatedly admitted that the symptoms he saw on the trees were also caused or could be caused by a number of other agents, but he made no investigation or attempt to do any type of laboratory analysis and further investigation to eliminate those causes.
Don't all those arguments go to the weight to be given that testimony?
No, they don't, because he has to have one logical scientific hypothesis that can be tested by the scientific method. It has to be reliable in order to be admissible. It doesn't go to the weight, it goes to whether or not it's sufficiently reliable to even be admitted in the courtroom. And the judge here had a hearing to determine reliability. Both sides were allowed to present arguments. They had evidence. He had before him the extensive deposition of Dr. Wickham. It was 5 volumes. There were 4 large notebooks with exhibits, which are in the court's record. He also took the matter under advisement and gave the Robinsons additional time to brief the question of scientific reliability under the United States Supreme Court decision in Daubert versus Merrill Dow.
You're asking us to adopt Daubert?
We're asking you to adopt a similar standard to Daubert, which we think is supported by Rule 702, which is identical to the federal rule which was interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court in Daubert. The Court of Appeals here completely ignored Daubert. What they did is say there's this three-part test that you look at, and this conscientious trial judge had no business even looking at reliability. All the trial judge can look at is some area of science generally relevant to the case? Is the expert qualified by skill, education, experience? And does his specialized area bear on some area of the case? It's really more a ritual than an meaningful analysis of admissibility under 702. And for that reason, we are asking the court to look at a reliability and relevancy standard similar to that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted, interpreting identical federal rule 702, and that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals uses with identical Texas Court of Criminal Rule 702.
Would that apply to all expert testimony, or as your adversaries say, the lower federal courts have applied Daubert to novel scientific evidence and not to, for example, I think shade tree mechanics who testify in products liability cases and things like that?
Well, Justice Cornett, the rule does not distinguish between novel science and other science. It just talks about scientific knowledge.
So across the board?
It would be across the board. I think that there's some areas that will become more routine over time and won't be challenged on a regular basis because they will be established by prior decisions to be reliable.
So would all expert testimony in medical malpractice cases or all the types of cases on which expert testimony may be required require out-of-court testing, animal studies, publication in scientific journals and that sort of thing before we would even allow it to be considered by a finer fact in Texas court?
Well, that has not proven to be the case in the federal courts, and they've had 2 years of experience under Daubert now. But in a traditional medical malpractice case, there are different types of generally accepted ways of diagnosing particular injuries or causation, and the courts have regularly applied those, like differential diagnosis in a specific injury case or looking to epidemiological, that word I can't pronounce, studies in kind of these larger birth defect type cases. So no, I don't think it's going to be in every case by any means.
Well, as in our last case that was argued that you were in the audience listening to, a bare opinion of causal connection absent some underlying testing or out-of-court experiment or something like that would not be sufficient under your theory, would it?
No, it would not be because it would be just the personal opinion and not science.
And that would be a change in Texas law, would it not?
No, not really. What I think it would be is kind of an amplification of past cases or a reaffirmance of past cases. This court has looked at situations like this, for example, in Schaefer versus TEIA, which was a Texas Supreme Court case from 1980. There was a question about whether the expert's testimony was legally sufficient to support a finding that an injury was occupationally caused. And there, the worker had atypical tuberculosis. And it was alleged that he got it because there was bird droppings in the soil where he worked. And birds do carry a strain of tuberculosis. But they did not test the soil to see whether it had that particular type of bacteria in it. And they did not do a serum test to see what strain he had. He didn't even know he had the avian strain. And that really was a reliability examination. The court called it a speculation type, no evidence review. But it still basis goes down to, did the expert do what is necessary under the scientific method to reach that causal connection before it should be counted as evidence or told to a jury?
Wouldn't we have to disapprove Havner versus Easy Mark?
No,
where,
Your Honor.
The court appeared to say that bare expert testimony alone supplied some evidence of a causal link in a negligence case.
Justice Cornett, I know that you wrote in Havner. It is distinguishable, though, because there we didn't have a direct scientific knowledge type question. That was not scientific expert testimony.
So where it's not science, but it's still opinion testimony, a bare opinion will suffice.
Well, I think that's another question, and I think that's going to depend on similar factors of is it speculative or is it not speculative, and is there a sufficient basis for the expert's opinion so that the expert has more knowledge than the jury in that situation.
Ms. Barron, a respondent makes a very forceful argument, I think, and help me talk me out of it, that to adopt, for Texas to adopt Daubert would in effect be such a departure, and they make several points. That in effect, their points are, bottom line is that the cure is worse than the disease, and they make several points, and I would like for you to comment on these things, that the rule would create a logistical nightmare for Texas courts, the rule would increase the time and cost of litigation, the rule would provide no guidance to courts and litigants, the rule would force courts and litigants into the role of amateur scientists, and the rule would create more problems than it would solve. Why are they wrong in each instance?
Well, Justice, that's also a packed question. I'll try and answer as many as I can. On the amateur scientist issue, I know that Justice Rehnquist used that term in his concurring and dissenting opinion in Daubert, but I think it's become more of a label than really anything that advances the debate. We have to start with a proposition that the scientific reliability is going to be determined by somebody in the litigation no matter what. So it's not a whether it's going to happen, but it's going to, who is going to do it and when is that going to happen.
And the proper people to do that is the jury. Let the jury decide as opposed to the trial court.
Well, Rule 702, though, makes it scientific knowledge a precondition to admissibility, and it does assign that role to the trial judge. And the trial judge in Rule 104 hearing does have more flexibility to ask questions, to get more information, to proceed without sticking to the normal rules of evidence. So that's a good form to make this decision. It also, their argument starts with the idea that it's useful for parties and courts to spend their resources presenting and rebutting unreliable evidence in the courtroom. And that's a false assumption. You can't assume that that's a very good use of our time and money. And I think that our case in particular is a good example of how it saved a lot of time and money. This was supposed to be a two-week trial, and the judge was very conscientious and did his work here, and it was reduced really to a one-day hearing before the court, and appropriately so, because the evidence was unreliable, and we didn't need to spend 2 weeks of all the parties' resources going through it. I think turning to Daubert, what the court needs to look at if it's considering that type of standard are some of the specific factors that the court itemized there. And I think the overriding concern is that the court must make a preliminary assessment of whether the reasoning is scientifically valid. Do you have a logical hypothesis that is then verified by scientific methods? And that's clearly what we don't have in this case. You don't have good grounds to extrapolate from one step to the next. What Wickham does is he begins at the end and then works his way backwards to assume contamination and to assume appropriate levels to cause damage. I'd invite the court to look at the Eighth Circuit's decision in Sorensen versus Shakely, which is at 31 F3rd 638. That involved a parallel situation where the plaintiff's experts were going to testify that birth defects had been caused by the parent's ingestion of contaminated alfalfa tablets. And what the court said about what they were doing was the experts are assuming contamination, and the experts are assuming contamination at a sufficient level to cause harm. What they're saying is this doesn't follow scientific principle. That inference turns scientific analysis on its head. Instead of reasoning from known facts to reach a conclusion, the experts here have reasoned from an end result in order to hypothesize what needed to be known but was not. And that's what's happening here. The court also itemized four non-exclusive factors. I'd ask the court to consider some other ones that have been mentioned in other sources. For example, Professor Sutton in his Texas Rules of Evidence Handbook, which is repeatedly cited in the respondent supplemental brief, suggests that the court look at the non-litigation uses to which the particular science has been put. The Ninth Circuit remand opinion that just came down on January 10th in Daubert versus Merrill Dow also uses this as a factor. And the question is the expert brought in to do the experiment and do the work just for this litigation, or was it done independent of and did it pre-exist this? Because that is indicia of reliability if it's pre-existing. In addition, there's also a question about which came first. Did the conclusion come first and the opinion come first, and then there's some scientific method kind of thrown out there to validate it? Or did you really start with a logical hypothesis and work your way naturally to a conclusion? What I point to the court is that on October 3rd, Dr. Wickham issued his report to the Robinson saying contaminated benlate causes problems. But at that time, he had not finished his 1992 study. He had not seen virtually every one of the DuPont documents on which they now rely. He had not visited any other pecan orchards. And further, may I finish this sentence, please? Further, what he had done, if you look at Exhibit 108 of the deposition exhibits, 18 times before that at least, he had opined to other people that it was contamination in the benlate that had damaged their particular crop. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Farron, bottom line, you are asking this court to adopt Daubert. the proper standard.
Yes, I'm asking this court to join the mainstream of other states in the federal court.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Lane Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honors. The Court of Appeals, in my judgment, correctly determined that Dr. Whitcomb's opinion and testimony was admissible under current Texas law. It was not only admissible under current Texas law, but it was admissible even if the court hypothetically had already adopted, not the Daubert rule. We're talking here today about the Daubert rule, the Daubert dictum. The only thing the Daubert opinion did was to overrule the Frye case, and I think Justice Rehnquist points that out very pointedly in his dissent. And the only thing that was done in Daubert was to reject the more restrictive rule of the Frye test and adopt frankly, a more liberal rule leading to the more admissibility of opinion testimony as contrasted with Frye. The methodology that was used by Dr. Whitcomb in this case demonstrates the type of Pandora's box that we're going to open if someone of the qualifications and background of Dr. Whitcomb is stricken, totally excluded in the courts of this state. Then there really, truly will be mass confusion about what in the world can you do to offer evidence that's necessary in certain types of cases, legal malpractice, medical malpractice, causation in certain products cases and things of that nature.
But apart from this case, and I understand the argument about this case, what can or what should the courts do to try to limit opinion testimony from hired gun expert witnesses who will testify to anything for a fee?
I think, Your Honor, that if you were to carefully review and look at the Law Review article, in the American University Law Review article, that is cited in our brief, I think it is absolutely essential to a fair, balanced understanding of whether this problem exists or it doesn't. We get off into anecdotal examples, and I'm certainly, and I guess my point is, if you analyze carefully the underlying premise that, you know, shade tree mechanics are running rampant and that toxic cases all over the United States are being tried and, you know, won by plaintiffs on tenuous evidence, the facts do not bear that out. And the facts, there are no facts that I think exist in the state of Texas that would justify this court to summarily, by judicial opinion here, just quickly and summarily say, we're going to change the rule that's been in existence for over a century that permits experts once qualified to express opinions and then leave the challenge to their opinions to the good judgment of a jury.
But isn't there a difference between qualifications and method? I mean,
there is a difference.
A perfectly qualified person may mess up.
Sir, there certainly is. And historically, all I'm trying to say, Justice Act, is that historically in Texas, once there has been an understanding that there is qualifications, as there was here, where the other side admitted the qualifications of Dr. Whitcomb, where that has occurred, and historically, the problems as to his method have been left to the sound judgment of juries. Now, the Daubert, if this court were to say, without studying in great detail a number of problems that arise, not just the ones that Justice Gonzalez alluded to, the ones of many trials and the time requirements that's going to place on our courts, the problems of cost, uncertainty, and so forth. There are a number of other very substantial problems that this court, it seems to me, as the head of the judiciary in this state, would want to very carefully weigh and consider in a thoughtful way before just writing an opinion that just says, henceforth, we're adopting the Daubert dictum. Now here, for example, in this very case, it was clearly understood by the trial judge and by counsel for both sides that a ruling by the trial judge that would totally exclude Dr. Whitcomb's testimony would, in essence, amount to a summary judgment in the case. It would amount to a ruling that would cause the plaintiffs to be unable to meet a burden that they had under the existing law. So look at the situation that we're in. In Daubert, the trial judge granted a summary judgment. Here, knowing full well what was about to happen, I mean, they went through this little trial, the record's very clear. They understood that they were just doing that almost as a formality to have some sort of record to go up on appeal. But it comes up on appeal now where the judge, in essence, granted a summary judgment knowing what was going to happen, and he comes up on an appellate review standard of abuse of discretion, as opposed to the appellate review standard that would have occurred had a summary judgment been granted, in which every reasonable inference would have had to have been indulged on behalf of the losing party, if you please. And I think if the court looks at the brief filed by the petitioner here, you'll find only passing reference, literally passing reference, subtle inferences to the fact that there was like a 50-page bill of exceptions in this case that detailed in elaborate detail Dr. Whitman, not only his qualifications, but the random tests that he did, the fact that he used something like 88 different miniature greenhouses, that he observed plants that were stunted, that tended to curve, that his study had been analyzed by Dr. William Ward, who concluded a 99.99% probability that benlate damaged the plants and trees. Now, this was a professor of statistics.
Fisher, on this point that you're going to, as I see the issue in Daubert that was raised, it talks in terms of reliability, but it really, as I perceive it, is really a no-evidence issue. It's the court's wrestling with an opinion expressed to the jury that has no support in the scientific community and therefore is not worthy of being considered evidence that would support a judgment. So I see what you're saying about the problem coming up on abuse of discretion, but it seems to me that this is not a question of the jury weighing the reliability of or the accuracy of the scientific opinion. This really is a court attempting to wrestle with the threshold issue of whether or not this scientific method is any evidence that would support the verdict based that would be based on that opinion. In this regard, it seems to me, if the Daubert standard was adopted in this case, would the record below that you have with regard to your expert meet the test, as you say, the more liberalizing how you get scientific evidence, would what your expert did satisfy the Daubert test?
Absolutely. I mean, if it doesn't, I don't know as a trial lawyer how you would go about trying to satisfy it any better. On the question of whether the method that he uses has been tested, he uses a well-known scientific principle, or at least a basis called comparative symptomology. It's used, as we're speaking, radiologists all over the state are using x-rays, looking at them, comparing them to others in order to make diagnoses. People are using mice experiments in order to be able to have the benefit of more generations and then making interpolations from that. It's been peer-reviewed, that is this type of methodology. The rate of error was calculated by a professor of statistics at Oklahoma State University. That's another of the three things that Daubert, in its so-called general observations, and that's all that occurred in Daubert. They said, we now make some general observations after we've decided the issue before the court. We meet those standards, Your Honor.
Do you agree that there needs to be a review of the method to be sure it's admissible? Some review.
Well, we have the... it depends upon the particular case, and what I worry about is if the court writes an opinion that implies or suggests that it's mandatory, that in every case, we really will, I think. We're not setting up some sort of straw man to knock down. I think we'll have a tremendous problem.
But surely you agree that the method can be so...
Absolutely. It's under Rule 104 that clearly provides right now that questions of admissibility of evidence shall be predetermined, in essence, if that's properly raised, in front of the court. We have
so the dispute as to how to do it and where the state
right. But the basic philosophical difference where the road forks is letting trial judges sit in a position of judging the weight and credibility of methodology where historically 100% of the time that has been done by juries once there has been a preliminary showing of qualifications, which we meet here and which, again, were conceded in the record, and we cited it in the brief to
do you have to have some independent review of the methodology as well as the qualifications, or is it your position that if the person is qualified, then no matter what holes there are in the methodology, it comes in?
It's my position that under existing Texas law for over a century, once there is a threshold showing of qualification that the sole judge of the weight and credibility of that testimony should be the jury and not that of the trial judge.
And is that because juries are better qualified to make that decision? Or are you arguing that it's a matter of democratic theory, that it's a decision that we allocate to the juries to decide as opposed to judges?
I'm arguing, as many others more eloquent than me have argued, that it's not because juries are necessarily better qualified than judges. They are in many, many, many instances. But it's a matter of fundamental principle in a democratic system. And the Seventh Amendment goes back to point out, as Judge Rehnquist in the Park Lane Hosiery case says, no amount of argument that a few procedural device provides for more efficiency or more accuracy or is fair will save it if the degree of invasion of the jury's province is greater than that allowed in 1791. And he points out, as the American Bar Association pointed out in 1992 in a symposium with the Brookings Institute, where they studied, they had defense lawyers, plaintiff's lawyers, scientists, various others, and they concluded that there was no basis to believe that a jury of so-called experts were in a better position really to decide these cases than juries. And I find it interesting that the patent law, there's a movement even in the Patent Law Association away from the so-called super juries of experts back toward a more traditional notion.
But in some places it has been and still is the case that a polygraph expert, no matter how well qualified he may be, no matter what his credentials are, he's not going to be allowed to testify to polygraph evidence.
Yes.
The method itself is not dependable as opposed to the qualifications.
Justice Eck, I think that absolutely a court has, using sort of a no-evidence type of standard, on the authority to conduct a preliminary hearing, and if they don't believe that what is being presented even rises to the level of relevant admissible evidence under Rule 104, they have the current authority to exclude that under our existing rules without writing about the Daubert dicta. But my point is, once you imply to the bar and to the judiciary, to the trial judges of our state, that it's sort of mandatory, no one can put an expert on in the state of Texas unless there has been a preliminary hearing, and that's what a lot of people are arguing is the import of Daubert. If that's really true, then it's not setting up a straw man to suggest you've created a tremendous, tremendous problem for your trial judges and the trial bar of the state. And I suggest to the court that this is not a case in which there's some sort of glaring injustice because a man with a PhD in horticulture, agronomy, conducted reams of tests that were randomly checked by a professor of statistics at Oklahoma State. This isn't a case where it's such a glaring injustice that it should become the immediate focal vehicle through which we change this law. Why couldn't the court, through its traditional role as administrator of the judiciary system in this state, through the Supreme Court Advisory Committee or through a select committee, have a careful, considered study of this problem? Is it a problem, first of all, and if so, what is an appropriate method by which we here in Texas could go about trying to solve it? Because this is not a problem just for plaintiff's lawyers in personal injury cases. This is a problem in condemnation cases. It's a problem in all of your oil and gas cases throughout the panhandle that involve potential ground and subsurface pollution from oil and gas activities. It's a problem in marital law where you have lawyers trying to offer evidence about what the value of a business or a law practice or a dental or medical practice is, and the objection is going to be you're just speculating.
So I want to get back to your answers to Judge Corman's questions, not only for this case, but for the court's future cases and its rulemaking authority. Are you suggesting that there is a constitutional problem whenever this court changes a rule of evidence by case law or formal rule to exclude some evidence from the jury's consideration which would have been allowed in 1876? Like if back then people thought a blow to the head could cause cancer, or a blow to the body, and so that kind of thing was testified about, and we now think that that's been scientifically debunked, and so we don't allow that type of testimony to go to the jury. Is that a problem that rises to constitutional magnitude?
Yes, it does rise to constitutional level. It doesn't go back so that we apply the factual standards that were present in 1791, but it was a clear delegation to the jury system under a democratic process of government. It was a clear delegation to juries as the ones who would decide the weight and credibility of evidence, not only throughout the United States, but particularly in Texas. The Texas Constitution has what has been described by some cases and some commentators as even a more rigid requirement relative to trial by jury even than the Seventh Amendment. And I'm not prepared to give you the exact citation, but I know that that's
there. So any time we're amending the rules of evidence or writing an opinion, we've got to go back and look at what went to juries in 1876, and that,
no, sir.
That's kind of an inner core that can't
be changed. I think that the question is not so much what went to juries in 1791. I think the question is, are we now removing from the jury an inherent power that is constitutionally granted to juries? And if you're going to do that by this opinion, it has constitutional implications in my judgment. And surely that is the case. If you're now going to have the person who decides on the weight and credibility of these various experts to be independent judges, as opposed to 12 people. Now, I've had several degrees and have been fortunate in my life to have some honors attached to some of my degrees, and I promise you that when you get 12 jurors on there, some of whom know how to rebuild an engine, some of them know how to wire a home with electricity, you've got aircraft mechanics, people that have expertise in air conditioning, all sorts of things on these juries, I suggest to you that they are as qualified as any one of us to make a determination about whether an expert is on the right path or whether he's off, in some sort of junk science here.
So why do we have any qualifications for experts?
Because
if it's true that we just let anybody get up on the stand and testify.
Because the determination of who is an expert is something perhaps that needs to be looked at. There may be some instances where some lax rulings have been made as to who really has expert opinion and who doesn't. And there have been a lot of cases where people have wanted to opine about certain things and the courts have said, wait a minute, you're not being any help because that's really not an area of expertise. The Daubert, but one thing I think the court should consider is in the Daubert opinion on page 485, it alludes to what this is really all about here, what we're all doing here, relative to thinking about these rules and thinking about juries. And they say in Daubert that the rules of evidence were designed not for the exhaustive search for cosmic understanding, but for the particularized resolution of legal disputes. And what that means to me is we can find anecdotal evidence to support any argument that we want to make. We can find shade tree mechanics that, you know, maybe have testified to things they shouldn't. But on the other hand, we weren't, simply because you can point out such an example does not undermine the basic strength of the jury system and the constitutional right of juries to continue to make this. And I just say that it ought to be studied very, very carefully. I'm not suggesting that everything's perfect, but it needs to be carefully, I think, reviewed and very deliberately before sweeping changes are made.
Mr. Fisher, before you sit down, this parade of horribles that you list in your brief, that there would be bad policy and it would be unworkable to adopt, Daubert. Ms. Barron says this hasn't happened in federal court in 2-year experience since Daubert. What is your response?
I don't think it's happening in some federal courts, and I think it probably is happening in others. But it just depends on how an opinion is written. I don't think enough time has gone by that anybody can make a concrete statement that this is not happening, or it is happening. Just hasn't been enough time to provide an agenda.
Thank you, Cal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, let me attempt to identify 3 questions that I think are running through the court's very thoughtful questions and opposing counsel's well-stated argument. Those questions would be why Daubert, or why any standards for the admission of scientific evidence. Is the adoption of Daubert a change in Texas practice? And third, why not Mr. Whitford? Or is Daubert met?
Or his what?
Is Daubert met on this record?
Would you take that point up first?
I will be glad to, Your Honor. There are no valid scientific principles that underlie Mr. Whitcomb's conclusions in this case, which is the principal dollar issue. But let me come back to that. There has been no peer review of the so-called comparative symptomology that he does. And I think opposing counsel probably is not aware, since he is fairly new to the case, that the comparative symptomology test was not even done or completed until he reached this conclusion in this particular case. There has been no subjection to peer review in this case. The error rate is unestablished in his methodology. What counsel has told you about the error rate is the error rate in this particular test. There is no established error rate for the methodology. And the degree of acceptance in the scientific community of his methods and principles is not established at all insofar as what he is intending to do in regard to a con argument. Now let me narrow that one, which is a very important one, because that is a sort of a sub-Fry standard, sort of Fry-like. There are 3 things that I think that the court would want to look at in determining why Daubert is not met. Number one, the facts or data upon which Mr. Whitcomb relied have not been independently verified by any witness other than Mr. Whitcomb himself as being data relied upon by the scientific community. Number two, his conclusions are highly dependent upon his own subjective determinations. And number 3, the opinions were developed solely for litigation and not in court. Literally, when you apply Daubert across the board, it does not meet any of the standards. But I do think that the critical thing for this court is
a problem with his analysis or methodology. He assumes contamination. Is that the problem?
Well, Your Honor, he actually assumes 3 critical facts in evidence. The Robinson's been late was contaminated with SUs. That SUs, at some level, will damage an orchard. He can't tell you what level. But at some level, it will damage an orchard. And that SUs were present in the Robinson's orchard at that particular level. He assumes all of those facts, but at the same time he assumes those facts, he fails to exclude the other causes which would cause the symptoms. And therefore, his test is never self-validated. And you can read his deposition and see this so beautifully. After emblazoning his comparative symptomology studies and assaying all of his literature in which he can match symptoms of plants, and the plants will then talk to him and tell him that if I see these symptoms, I know all of those three critical things happen. He was asked, well, let me bring you four conjugates that you've never seen before. And look, this symptom you say is related to SU contamination. This symptom, yellowing, hooked leaf, sugar shell, misformed fruit. Now, tell me, Dr. Whitman, based on science, was that plant treated with and damaged by Benray? I have no idea. I can't tell you. But the reason he can't do that is because he doesn't have the three things. He doesn't know whether it was done. And he has not done anything to exclude other causes.
But as Justice Spector pointed out in her initial question, these questions historically have been weight and credibility for the jury, for the trial court.
I just disagree with that entirely, Judge Gonzalez. As sincerely as I know you asked the question, in the area of science, when we put a scientific expert on the stand, we give him an imprimatur to the jury under the rule 702 that his opinion will not necessarily be one they adopt, but will be derived by some methods or principles that are reliable. If science would not accept the methods and principles, why should a jury? Why should a jury be asked to do that? All that's going on in the adoption of Daubert is not the assessment of the conclusion, but it's an assessment of the procedures, principles, and methodology by which that has been derived. And I would suggest to you that's not a change. Not a change at all. In Holt Etherton Industries, this
court answer is going beyond.
Let me ask you.
It was a long sentence.
Let me ask you one
there was
of
that. A comma, I think.
You had to stop. Had to stop to catch your breath there. You're saying that the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in excluding this testimony, but would it have been within the trial court's discretion to allow this testimony?
Oh, that's a good question, and I do not think so for the reasons that that had been identified by post. Daubert cases, which we are going to supply the court, which state that the type of reasoning in which he assumes a conclusion and then reasons backward to tell you how he got there is not what's known as scientific reasoning. The Sorensen case that Ms. Barron talked to the court about says this: here the hypotheses presented by plaintiff's expert follow no scientific principle. Those are principles reason that because Christopher and Katrina sustained birth defects, such as mental retardation, and their parents used Shackley's alpha tablets, alfalfa, and because some alfalfa tablets had contained an ETO residue, the parents must have ingested the ETO residue. That inference turns scientific analysis on its head. Instead of reasoning from known facts to reach a conclusion, the experts have reasoned from an end result in order to hypothesize what method needed to be known but was not. And that encapsulates Mr. Whitman to the T.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chairman. That concludes the argument in this clause. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will please adjourn the court.